I think the last thing we did was review. We read through the details of Perek Yud Aleph. That's what I have in my notes.
Yes.
Perek Yud Aleph is the story of Yavesh Gilad. Nachash Ha'amoni, who comes, attacks Yavesh Gilad with the effort to, with the threat to annihilate Yavesh Gilad or to enslave them, to subjugate them. There's this whole kind of sidebar. A lot of these stories are pretty gory. I mean, if you thought Pelegish B'Gipper was gory.
Oh,
there have
been some worse ones in this.
Exactly. And so you know, the eye kind of hovers out there. It's one of the more significant ones, right, where he says, Bin kor lachem kol ayin yamin, I will accept your terms with the removal of your right eye, which on the one hand reads as if you have to do it to yourself, which I don't actually think was Nachash's intention. I think his intention was, you know, that's what it will cost you, you know, which we will do that to you. By the way, other examples. We looked at Shimsh at Adoni Bezek with the thumbs, and we looked at Shein Va'ayin in the midst of Shein Va'ayin and Parashat Mishpatim. But there are other more direct examples of this business about the eye. Most famously, what did the Plishtim do to Shimshon when they captured Shimshon?
They blinded him.
What did the Babylonians do to Tzidkiyahu when they captured him?
They blinded him.
Right? This was not an uncommon context. And the response was, as we saw that very complex verse about, we'll give us 7 days to see if there's somebody who can come and save us and destroy you, and if not, then we will surrender to you. And we had a conversation about whether they actually articulated that or just thought it. Right. Mephoshim said they articulated it. They said, we'll give us 7 days to see if we can make this a national campaign, and if not, then we'll surrender. And then they come to Givat Shaul. Shaul comes back from his shepherding of the flock, hears that they're all crying about the poor Yavesh Gilad, and he goes, gathers his army and goes to war. So the pasuk that I want to pick up on is pasuk Zayin. Pasuk Vav and Zayin.
This is Yud Aleph, right?
Perek Yud Aleph, pasuk Vav and Zayin. Atitzlach ruach Elokim al Shaul, ki shamo et hadvarim ele, vayicha apo meod. Ruach Elokim enveloped Shaul as he heard these things, and he was angry. He was moved to anger. Moved to anger, anger has a double, in a sense, has two roles. Anger can be a function of punishment. Right? So God says, when God gets angry, it's usually a reflection of something that we've done wrong, and therefore a function of punishment. Anger can be an injustice can move somebody to anger. Anger can be reflected. Sorry, this is leaking. Anger can be a function of losing control and being angry. It's not a personal grudge. But here, Vayicha Pomo'od, I think it's clear that the reflection of anger is a very positive one because it's one of motivation. He's angered by the injustice of it, and therefore it motivates him to act. That kind of spontaneous response, see an injustice, see a crisis, see something that needs a response to. Vatitzlach alav ruach Elokim enveloped him, whether we define it as divinely inspired courage or ruach HaKodesh, or however we define it, it certainly reflects a mode of response that is reminiscent of the kind of leadership we saw in Sefer Shoftim. People are in crisis, there's an enemy attacking, there's no leader, the people need a response, and the response is, somebody comes along, Vayakum Lahem Moshiach, right? Somebody comes along that God appoints or sends or motivates or inspires. Mm-hmm. And that individual rises to the occasion to save Israel from their enemy, and then he assumes the leadership post facto. Well, that's essentially the cycle of Sefer Shoftim.
One of the things. Sarah Poe. Mm-hmm. That always signifies anger, but actually, what does it mean? It's like
an idiom. No? It's an idiom. It's an idiom to the notion of blowing air through one's nostrils. Nostrils flared.
Says his anger burned greatly.
Right, because it's an idiom to the notion of flaring one's nostrils, because that's what you do when you're angry, right? Like a bull,
mm-hmm.
Right? So the model of leadership here is very important because it's at the core. One of the questions that we're looking at is the difference between the model of leadership of a shofet and the model of leadership of a melech. Remember that the whole notion of the appointment of a melech was the theme of Perek Chet and Tet, and then we kind of stopped. Shaul went home, Shmuel went home, everybody went home, and the kind of the story came to an end. And now we're restarting the story. There's an enemy, he attacks. I mean, this story would fit very neatly if you stuck it into Sefer Shoftim. If you isolated it without any context that came before or after, and you just stuck it into Sefer Shoftim, it would just be one of those iterations of Sefer Shoftim. And even the phrase Moshiach, which we saw last week, was a kind of guide word, Milat Mancha, in this story. What do they say? They say, people of Yavish Gilad said to Nachash, Pasuk Gimel, Heref lanu shivat yamim v'nishlacha malachim v'chogvu Yisrael v'im ein Moshiach otanu v'yatzanu lefanecha. If there's no Moshiach, somebody to save us, then we'll come out to fight with you. We saw it at least three times in this story. Pasuk Tet. V'yamul malachim v'im kotamun l'ish avesh gilad machar tiye lanu tshua kilchom ha-shamash. Right. We will have tshuva, we will have salvation, we will have somebody who will come and be Moshiach for us.
Save us.
Even if you go back to the end of Perek Yud, when the people sort of acted disparagingly towards Shaul, uvnei v'leal amru ma yoshienu zeh. What is this one going to do to save us? The term tshuah, the term yeshua, is a term which we'll find as part of the role of any military protection of the people is to save them from the hands of their enemies. But the terminology, the identity of the individual leader as a Moshiach, is a term that we are intimately familiar with from Sefer Shoftim. Vayakum Hashem lehem Moshiach. The notion of the Shofet as a Moshiach for the moment. So that also tends to kind of integrate us into the mindset of the arena of Sefer Shoftim. And then the story itself is remarkably reminiscent of an episode in Sefer Shoftim. This we sort of where we ended up last week. Pasuk Zayin. Vayikach tzemet bakar vayinatcheu. What does Shaul do to motivate the people to come to war? He took a pair of oxen and he chopped them up. He sent pieces to the through the malachim to all of the different tribes of Israel, saying, anybody who doesn't come fight this war, thus shall be the fate of their Son, which I believe is another euphemism, right? Because I don't think he was threatening their sheep. I think he was threatening them. That's a nice way to say it, right?
Okay.
This is your fate if you don't come fight this war.
Because and he was going to hurt them, or because the country would be taken over by Christians?
He doesn't say it, but I suspect this is not the first time we've had a leader threaten the people who don't comply with the call to arms. Gideon did it. Remember Gideon? Right? Gideon did it twice. Penuel and Sukkot. And
let us forgive her. They chopped her up.
Right. So we're going to come to that in a moment. Vayipol pachad Hashem al ha'am. The fear of God fell upon the people. Right. To put it, to use the modern equivalent, he put the fear of God into them. That's an idiom for he threatened them. Vayitzu ki'ish echad. And they came like one man in unison, ready to fight. Vayifkedem bevazek vayuvnei Yisrael shlosh me'ot elef. V'ish Yehuda shlushim alef. 300,000 from Israel and 30,000 from Yehuda, they came with a fighting force of 330,000 people. That's a fighting force that could take Nachash down in a day. And that's exactly what happens. Go back, tell Yavesh, tomorrow, by noon tomorrow, the story will be over. You will have your salvation. Said the people of Yavesh to Nachash, tomorrow we will come to you, do to us what you want. That's exactly the two parts of the phrase that I think they quoted to them earlier, right? Give us 7 days and then we will go out to you. Right? That's further proof that they never articulated to Nachash that piece about sending messengers. He divides the people into three fighting groups, sends them against the camp, attacked in the morning, by noon the battle was over. The rest scattered, there wasn't two remaining together. We'll talk about the battle strategy at a different time. It's interesting to note that he sends three battalions in and not four. That's not an accident. Why three and not four? What does three tell you? Why do I need three battalions? Why isn't it just one frontal attack?
Side.
Right, three sides. Right, it's an attack from three sides. So if you're already attacking from three sides, why not from four?
So they can escape.
Right. So this, it's actually a halacha. They're not allowed to attack an enemy from all four sides. You have to allow them an escape route. And it's strategically valuable because an enemy that's got its back to the wall and has no escape route will fight much more valiantly and harder because they have no choice. Give them an escape route, tactically, you give them an option to run. And that's exactly what happened. So from both tactically and ethically, I think, to an extent, there's this halacha that you're not allowed to surround an enemy on four sides.
Is there any reason there were so many here? There's
yes.
Some times where we have only a few attacking a whole, whole army or two armies, and now we've got this massive amount attacking.
Correct. He turned this into a national campaign. This wasn't a tribal campaign. This wasn't an individual shevet. He turned this, Shaul turned this into a national campaign. He wanted every tribe to show up. Uniting everybody, and that's part of the mandate of a melech, is to unite the people, no question. I think there's actually much more to it. I'm going to do Yavesh Gilad and Peleg Shvegiva as a subunit of this story when we come back to it. In other words, we're going to read this whole piece of, just to give you a sort of a picture of where I'm going with the approach to the rest of this year and the beginning of next year. We have three or four classes left. I sort of want to get an overview of the story of Shaul. So we're going to do a bird's eye view of a couple of Shaul's stories. But then we're going to go back to it because there's a lot of depth that we need to explore. And to do that, we have to go back to the story of Peleg Shvegiva. You can't really understand what's going on here without understanding the backdrop to it, which is the story of Peleg Shvegiva. That's a big debate because it depends on when there are two stories at the end of Sefer Shoftim that are not dated, and there's a machloket mefarshim what the date of those two stories are. Are they early stories that are put at the end of the book, or are they later stories chronologically in sequence? We discussed that back in Sefer Shoftim. I tend to see them as early stories that are put at the end of the Sefer just to reflect the era of the time, which means that they're several, possibly even several hundred years ago. But the implication and the ramification of those stories, I think, stays in the national psyche of Israel forever. The Leg Shbagiv is one of those stories that, because it was the near eradication of an entire tribe. Remember that Sheva Binyamin almost got wiped out. And they were only able to rehabilitate Sheva Binyamin at the very end by that, with 300, 400 remaining survivors by this other city that they had also nearly wiped out. Do you remember that story?
Mm-hmm.
That other also nearly wiped out because they didn't come to fight in the battle in the first place, and then discovered that they weren't part of the oath not to marry Binyamin, and so they married them together and were able to rehabilitate. If that story is the chronologically at the end of Sefer Shoftim, then between then and now is maybe 50, 60, maybe 100 years. It's hard to imagine out of 300 families in 100 years, it would rehabilitate an entire tribe. And there is an entire tribe of Binyamin. Whereas if it's several hundred years ago, it would make sense for Shaul to describe himself as a member of the smallest tribe of Israel, Miktanei Shiftei Yisrael, but it would also give it enough time for that rehabilitation to take place. So I tend to see it as an earlier story, but the details of that story are very much alive in the psyche of Israel. And the proof is that I think that when he cuts up the bakar, there's no way that's an accident. It happens twice in all of Tanakh. Mm-hmm. The phrase, Vayikach, Vayinatcheu, Vayishalach b'chol gvu Yisrael, and take a look at that phrase by itself, Shoftim Perak Chav Aleph, or Perak Chav, actually, I think it's actually Parakut Tet, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, Parakut Tet. Chaf Tet, the end of the Parak. Yeah, completely different context, albeit. But there too it says, Vayinatcheha la'atzameha. He took the dead body of the Pilagesh. Vayinatcheha la'atzameha. Cut it up by its limbs, lishne mesar netachim, vayishalcheha b'chol gvu Yisrael, and sent it to all of the tribes of Israel. Why did he do that? What was his motivation, the Levi's motivation there, in sending this package to each of the tribes of Israel? Right. He wanted them to come fight.
So this is the same thing.
And what happens? Look at Perakov Pasuk Aleph. The response to it is, Vayetzu kol b'nei Yisrael v'tikahel aida ki ish echad.
And that's right.
It's exactly the same phrase that's used here.
Right.
Then he gathered them all together ki ish echad.
Mm-hmm.
Now look at the numbers. There, the total number of Pasuk Bet, Vayetzu pinot kol am kol shiftei Yisrael, all the tribes of Israel represented, 400,000. When you gather the army of all the tribes of Israel, you're talking about an army of several hundred thousand. The numbers are not that significantly off. The number here is 330,000. So the parallel to these two stories is remarkably poignant, and the imagery is very powerful. It's the only two places in all of Tanakh where you find such a story of, you know, taking something, cutting it up, sending out, and saying, "This, if you don't come now, this is the result." I mean, in Shaul's case, it's a threat. In Shmuel, in Pelegish Begiva's case, it wasn't a threat. It was a kind of a motivation, inspiration. It was a call to arms, right? This is what happened. Come and fight for it. But in either case, the power of the two stories is remarkable. Oh. So Yavesh Gilad is not Binyamin. Yavesh Gilad is in the Gilad. Yavesh Gilad is in Menashe, out there in the Gilad. When we redo this and go through the details of Pelegish Begiva, we'll talk about Yavesh Gilad per se. But what's important to note is the name of the city that was the outside city that didn't come and fight against Binyamin in that story. And that ultimately they went and destroyed because they didn't fight against Binyamin.
Because they're on the other side of Jordan.
Right. And that they came and rehabilitated Binyamin with, that city was Yavesh Gilad. So the Yavesh Gilad is the centerpiece of the story of Pelegish Begiva. How much it's the centerpiece, we talked about when we learned the story 4 years ago. That's the piece that I want to review with you, but I don't want to do it now because it'll take us at least a month. It'll take us at least 5 or 6 shiurim to go through the story again, and I don't want to do that now. But that's where I want to start from again, is to understand the relationship between Yavesh Gilad and Binyamin, because you don't really get Shaul and what his unique role was dafka from Shevet Binyamin without seeing the backdrop of Shaul leading the charge in defense of Yavesh Gilad on the other side of the Yarden.
I remember that.
Okay. The imagery here in this symbolism is remarkably important. Shaul from Shevet Binyamin reminding everybody about Pelegish Begiva, leading all the tribes of Israel in a war in defense of Yavesh Gilad, when previously all the tribes of Israel in their war against Binyamin went and destroyed Yavesh Gilad. That's the irony of it, and I don't think it's ironic. I think it's intentional. I think the fact that it's Yavesh Gilad is precisely why the people are sitting and crying and going, poor Yavesh Gilad, and comes Shaul from Shevet Binyamin, and he says, Rabbosai, not again. We're not doing this. And he reminds them all about the story of Pelegish Begiva by taking this bakar, cutting it up, and sending it out, and said, okay, this is not happening. So it's the postscript to the story of Pelegish Begiva. All right. Subsequently, gathers all the people together. They come back to Gilad. They come back to Gilgal. Shmuel says, "It's time to unite the people together again and establish Malchus for the second time." Because the first time Perek Yud Aleph is when he has Perek Yud is when he has the ceremony where he appoints Shaul, we designate Shaul, and Shaul is nowhere to be found. Right? So the people are waiting, and right, that's in Perek Yud. Right, so again, in terms of sequence, the sequence of the Prakim here is important and quite strange. Perek Chet, they come and ask for a king, and God gets angry. Perek Tet, God comes to Shmuel, and he says, "Oh, I'm going to send you the perfect person. We're going to send you a king in Israel." And Shaul comes wandering into his city looking for his donkeys. Perek Yud, he sends him off on 3 Otot to see that he's being transformed into a kingly, royal, regal person. End of Perek Yud Aleph. Perek Yud, there's a public ceremony to appoint a king. Shaul chastises them for the chutzpah of wanting a king. And he says, but I'll give it to you anyway. Here's the king that you've chosen, Shaul ben Kish. There's nowhere to be found because he's hiding. Then he goes home, and there's a big debate amongst the people. Is he a good king? Is he a bad king?
Is he a king?
Is he a king? Is he what? That's more about, right? Okay. Is he a king? Perek Yud Aleph. Suddenly the scene shifts where Yavesh Gilad is threatened by Nachash, who was the original threat back in the beginning, Perkat. They come to the people of Binyamin. They're all crying. Yavesh Gilad is expendable. Shaul comes along, shows up one day, and he says, "Hi, I'm Shaul. You don't know who I am, but I'm going to kill you if you don't come to battle." It's very strange.
So what happened while he wasn't there?
And we don't know. And that's the mystery, right? So are the Prakim in order? Are the Prakim two stories? Is it the sequence? There's too much. It's almost as if the Navi goes back and forth between two completely different modes of kingship. In other words, if I isolated all the pieces of the story that presents Sha'ul in a and Malchus in a positive light, and all the pieces of the story that presents Sha'ul and Malchus in a negative light independently, they'd probably make sense. You put them together, and you have this chant, probably because that's exactly what the Navi wants us to see, that there's a complexity here that's not consistent. When in the end of the story, Shmuel says to the people, "Let's go to Gilgal, Lifnei Hashem Gilgal, and we will nechadesh sham hamilucha. We will start Malchus there. We'll anoint him. Before he was designated, now he's going to be coronated. Right? Whenever you have it's like the difference. It's like an election, right? You have an election, and then you have an inauguration. You have a designation of a king, and then you have an anointment, and then you have a coronation. So we've had the anointment. Now we're going to have the coronation. Perek Yudbet. But before we do that, what I want to look at are Shaul's major military campaigns. Because if we look at all three military campaigns of Shaul, at least from a bird's eye view, begin to get a sense of what's the strength and weakness of Shaul and where things get derailed.
Why did he have to go to Gilgal to crown him? What was the story with Gilgal?
That too is an interesting question. Why Dafke in Gilgal? Why do you think?
No, I don't know. I mean, the Mizbeach wasn't there. The Mishkan wasn't there, was it?
No, Mishkan wasn't there. So the Mefarshim said they brought the Aron there in order to have Lifnei Hashem. By the way, that water urn has got hot water in it. I filled it up this morning and turned it on for the benefit of
those people who are freezing
in the class and wanted hot water without the noise of the urn.
I know, I turned it off last time.
Right, so I had it turned on after davening so it would be ready.
I'm probably the only one drinking Kesavasser.
I do that too, so it's okay. All right. Where was I?
About why?
Oh, why Gilgal? Why Gilgal? Why do you think Gilgal? It's just a question, ultimately. Why Gilgal?
Where's your map that you have all those towns? See if it has rings about.
Gilgal is here, near Yericho. Which is not far, by the way, from Mitzpeh, which is where the first ceremony took place. And regionally, it's the same area. It's Shevet Binyamin. Mitzpeh was here in the mountain range. Gilgal is a little bit further to the coast, not far from the original location of Mitzpeh, which is where the first anointment ceremony that failed was. Now we're going to go to Gilgal, a little bit of a different place. Change of scenery, shinui makom, shinui mazel. Maybe it'll be better off the second time. Who knows? That's one possibility. I think there's a more significant symbolism to Gilgal.
I'm sure something happened there, but I don't remember what it was.
And on top of it all, it appears all the time. You know, Gilgal always.
Well, if you remember, Shmuel's instructions to Shaul were: at some point or another, in some battle, sometime in the future, you're going to come to Gilgal. You're going to wait for me for 7 days. And not offer the sacrifices until I come to you. That was to be in Gilgal. That was Perek Yud. Okay, back in Perek Yud, when he came to him at the very end and he said, or actually, it doesn't say there that it's in Gilgal. Oh, yeah, it does. Pasuk Chet. V'yaradata lefanai ha-Gilgal. At that point or another, you will come to me in Gilgal. V'hinei anochi yored elecha lehalot olot lisbach zivchei shlamim shivat yamim tochel ad bo'i elecha v'odati lecha tasher ta'aseh. I'm going to come, the battle will start with sacrifices. You'll wait 7 days before you bring sacrifices. You'll wait for me, I will come and do it. 7 days you'll wait. So that story is foretold back in Perek Yud is going to happen in Gilgal. That's not the coronation ceremony. It's another story, but it's the next one, but it's also in Gilgal.
No, but that's the foreshadowing of everything.
Right, so Gilgal plays a central role in Shmuel's story. Not an accident, it's a major city, and it's in Shevet Binyamin. So
it works, right?
Right.
We don't have a capital yet because we are pre-capital, pre-David, pre-Yerushalayim. So sitting in Binyamin, you're going to be somewhere in major cities, Ramah, Geva, Gilgal, Mitzpeh. It's the major centers that we know of in Binyamin. That's all true. There's probably an additional reason for Gilgal.
Where did Shaul find Shmuel in the first place?
Probably in Sofim, which is Shaul's in Shmuel's hometown. Oh. I'm a time Sofim. That was in Tzuf.
Eretz Tzuf. No,
right,
that's not the area at all. It's a completely different area. So there's the Mizbeach is in Gilgal. Is it there now?
That's what you said. I misunderstood.
The Mizbeach could be in Gilgal.
Where's the Aron?
They split that up.
They split the Aron and the Mizbeach. For some reason,
wasn't
I thought the Mizbeach. The Aron's in Kiryat Yearim, but for some reason I thought the Aron is in Nov at this point in time.
Well, I'm just telling you what I wrote.
Right.
So it's wrong, I'll erase it.
No, don't erase
well,
it. I have to look. It's possible that the Mizbech is in. I need a. Ruthie. Behind you. See if in the any of the mikrok the lot that has mefarshim on Shmuel. Any of the mikrok the lot that has actually mefarshim. You know what? Even the those are chumashim. Actually, you know what? The das mikra will have it. Do you have the das mikras down below? Yes. Yeah, the one. The first one. The first one. No, that's the second one. I need the first one. Thank you. No, they're both second. I have two volume twos.
Oh, here it is. It's on top.
Thank you.
Obviously, this must be important if
you're looking it up. I do think it's important, and the reason I think it's important is actually not whether or not the Mizbeach is there. That actually I think is secondary.
What's important about this?
Oh. Why is... Yeah, Givon. I think the Mizbeach goes to Givon. I don't think the Mizbeach is in Gilgal at this point.
Erase that.
I wouldn't erase it because it doesn't matter. Why is Gilgal? Let's go back in history. Let's go back in time. What's the most significant symbolism of Gilgal? Where does the story of Gilgal begin?
It's obviously an important event.
Come on, Janet.
I know. It's
Janet.
Bringing a bell.
Encyclopedia
it's like
here.
That's bugging me.
If you would take copious notes, you would know.
So what Dat Mikra says is Kanirea Kabanala Gilgal Smuchala Yericho is look this would seem to be the same Gilgal near Yericho. I would agree with that. V'hi b'makom sheikim Yisraim Yisrael et machanehem b'yovram b'tayarden b'yimei Yoshua. That's the place that Israel set their base camp when they crossed the Yarden in the days of Yoshua. V'hi nimtza'a b'derech me'eretz b'nei Amon le'eretz Binyamin. It's smack in the middle between Amon and Binyamin. Which is true, geographically. Amon is here, Binyamin is here, Gilgal is here. So if you want to establish a place that symbolizes a kind of frontier between Ammon and
and Israel, then Gilgal would work, although so would any area in here, on the other side of the Yarden. Though I don't believe that they would have established Malchus on the other side of the Yarden. I don't think that that would have sat well with the rest of the tribes. So that's one possibility for the establishment of Gilgal, for the restoration or the return to Gilgal. I think it's much more significant. What starts in Gilgal?
Is that where Yiftach lived, maybe a chance? Yiftach
is in the Gilad.
Oh,
Yiftach HaGiladi.
All right, never mind.
There's some kind of rebellion there?
Nope. What? He makes reference to it, and I think the key lies in that early reference point. What was the role of Gilgal when Bnei Yisrael first entered into the land of Israel?
When they first crossed over.
When they first crossed over, what was the role of Gilgal?
Is that where they divided up the land?
That is where the ceremony of the dividing of the land took place. Why? What was Gilgal?
The center?
I don't know. I know they had the whole thing of giving Brissim again.
Is this true? But I don't think that's just how the place got its name.
So back to Sefer Yeshua.
Back to Sefer Yeshua. That's how the place got its name. But in Sefer Yeshua, when they come into the land of Israel, Gilgal is base camp.
For a long time.
For too long.
Yeah.
Right? Remember, it's for too long, because Yeshua wants them to settle the land. So he moves the Mishkan from Gilgal to
Shiloh.
Gilgal is where the Mishkan was originally. Okay, the first 14 years, the Mishkan is in Gilgal. Then it's moved. That's why I don't think the Mizbeach is here anymore. I think the Mizbeach is in Givon or Nov. But the base camp here, the old symbol of Gilgal, was where the story of the settlement of the land of Israel began.
Where did they do all those stone things?
That was crossing the river,
It was crossing the river, but they took it up to Shechem. But something else happened in Gilgal as well. Something else happened in Gilgal. Jump to back to Perek Shoftim, Perek Bet. Vayal Malach Hashem in Gilgal al Abochim. Perek Bet was a very important perek for Sefer Shoftim. It was the perek in which the Navi comes to them and essentially chastises them for their beginning of their assimilation and the lack of conquest of the land of Israel, and describes for them the sequence of the cycle that will essentially define the history period of Sefer Shoftim. What's the cycle?
They become idol worshippers.
Right. Idol worshippers, punishment,
Tshuva.
Challenge, war, enemy.
Idol worship.
Cry out, maybe not, yay, maybe yes. Ultimately, a Moshiach. Vayakom Hashem lehem Moshiach. Vayakam Hashem Shoftim Vayoshium Miyad Shoseim. God would appoint for them Shoftim, and they would save them from the hands of their enemies, and then they would recycle the process. So Gilgal has a certain symbolism to them.
Even in the name?
In the location, the story of Gilgal is where the base camp of Israel, their settlement in the land of Israel begins in Gilgal. And Gilgal essentially represents for them the story of, with the beginning of, a history of leadership called
Shoftim.
The story of Sefer Shoftim begins in Gilgal. I don't think it's an accident that Shmuel takes them back to Gilgal, L'chadesh Sham Melucha, to reboot the leadership from Shofet to
Melech.
We're now starting Malchus. We're now starting a whole new formula. And in fact, it was the formula of the Shofet that the people rebelled against, because they wanted a king, they wanted an army, they wanted a draft, they didn't want Shoftim that were periodic and sporadic. They wanted consistent, permanent melech. They didn't want to be dependent upon the cycle of the shoftim, whatever, right? The spiritual obligations, whatever the issues were. To go back to Gilgal, to start Malchus in Gilgal, besides the geographic and military importance, besides the fact that it's in Sheva Binyamin, I think it takes us all the way back to the beginning of Sefer Shoftim.
Should have picked a different place. Shoftim didn't work.
No, I think it's intentional.
Does Gilgal have a meaning?
The name itself comes from the story of in Yeshua with the Brismila of the people and the Hayom Galoti et Chapat Mitzrayim Alechem the Galot to roll away. It's a the name
away?
To roll away the shame of Israel.
Right.
Gilgal in modern Hebrew is a circle, but I don't think that's maybe.
But just talking about the cycles, maybe.
I could also, but I think he actually, in his conscious mind, went back to Gilgal because that's where Shoftim started. If that's where Shoftim started, that's where Malchus is going to start. This is a transition. This is a break. This is a new era of history. So I think, I think that's why he takes him to Gilgal. Neither does it may. If we look at the question of the success or failure, and I'm going to skip for now the story in Gilgal and Perek Yudbet. I'm going to skip it now. I wanted to kind of just a bird's eye view of the remaining two major campaigns of Shaul and what went wrong in each of them. Because I think the source of what went wrong we can find back in the story of Hevesh Gilad. Now that's what I want to kind of begin to explore. So we're going to jump. We're going to go all the way to, we're going to work our way backwards. We're going to start from Amalek.
We're going back to Amalek.
We're gonna jump forward and then we're going backwards. So we're jumping to Amalek. Perek Tadvav. Shaul has three campaigns in his life. In his career. Three major campaigns. There's a whole bunch of other ones. But the three that are of interest to us are Perek Did Aleph, which is Yavesh Gilad, or the war against Nachash. Yud Gimel and Yud Dalid, which is referred to as the Battle of Michmas and the war against the Plishtim. And Tetvav, which is the Battle of Amalek. Those are the three major campaigns that Shaul fights. Yavesh Gilad, or the war against Nachash Amon, we just saw. We're going to read the beginning. We're going to read pieces of the story of Michmas and the war against the Plishtim and the war against Amalek.
So we're not even counting his pre thing with Yavesh Gilad before in Shoftim.
That wasn't Shaul.
I thought it was. I thought Shaul went to help Yavesh
Gilad. Just here? He is not born in Shoftim.
No, I didn't realize that. I thought he was in that story.
No, Shaul?
Yeah.
No. Shaul is either not born by it's either 50 years, just to put it in broad general terms, it's either 50 years before he's born or it's 300 years before he's born.
Oh, okay.
Depends on where you put the story. But Shaul is nowhere to be seen in Sefer Shoftim.
Okay. Why
are you going to Amalek?
Because there's three major battles. I could do it forward, but I think we'll see it better if we do it backwards. There's a piece of the story that I want to get to. We're not going to go through all the details, but there's one piece of the story that I want to get to. Take a look in Perek Tedvav. After he fails to destroy all of Amalek, which we will talk about at length, starting with Pasuk.
Is this his major downfall?
Well, this is his last. He fails.
I know it's his last, but is this his real major
downfall? As we do it backwards, we'll see that he has a failure in Perek in the previous case too. They build on each other.
This is strike three.
So this is you could call it that. Depends what you call strike one. Let's go start from Pasuk Yud Dalet. Vayomer Shmuel. Shmuel here is chastising Shaul for his failure in the Battle of Amalek. We do not know yet what that failure is. Says Shmuel, Vayomer Shmuel, Umet kol hatzon hazeh boznai. You know, let's go back one pasuk. Let's go back to start from Yud Gimel. Vayavo Shmuel Shaul Vayomer lo Shaul Baruch atah LaHashem Akimoti Dvar Hashem. Shmuel shows up, sees Shaul. Shaul comes running out to him and he says, Baruch Hashem, I fulfilled what God told me to do. I did exactly what God told me to do. I battled and conquered Amalek. Vayomer Shmuel Umekol hatzon hazeh boznai. So, wait a second. If you did what I told you to do, why do I hear the sound of bleeding sheep? Call a bakar asher anichli shamea, and all the ox. Vayomer Shaul me'amaleki heviyu. We brought them from Amalek. Asher chamal ha'am al meitav atzon ve'abakar. The people had compassion on the best of the sheep and cattle. Leman zavach l'Hashem elokecha. In order to bring sacrifices and expressions of hadah to Hashem. V'tiyateh echramnu. The rest we destroyed. V'yomer Shmuel o Shaul heref v'gid alcha t'ashet diber Hashem elai ha'layla v'yomer lo daber. Shaul, stand back. I'm going to tell you what God said. Vayomer Shmuel, Haloim katonata b'einecha, Rosh shiftei Yisrael ata. You may think yourself small in your own eyes. This pasuk we've read before. You are the leader of the tribes of Israel. Vayim shechacha Hashem lamelech Yisrael. God appointed you king over Israel. Vayishlachacha Hashem badach, Vayomer lech v'echaramta tachataim et amalek, v'nilchamta bo'ad kalotam otam. God told you to destroy Amalek until they were finished. Why did you not listen to God's voice? Instead, you vata'at el hashalal. You
rushed after the spoil.
Rushed after, ran after.
Fly upon the spoil.
What does it say?
Fly upon.
That's a good expression. But fly upon the spoil. Right? You pounced on them. God told you to destroy everything, and here you went and you grabbed spoils of war. V'tas hara b'nei Hashem, this was evil in the eyes of God. V'yomer Shaul el Shaul, so Shaul responded in El Shmuel and said, Asher shemati b'kol Hashem, I did what God told me. V'elech b'derech ha'shishlachani Hashem, I went in exactly the way that God told me to go. V'vi et Agag melech ha'malek, v'et ha'malek echramti, I captured Agag and I killed Amalek. Vayikach ha'am mehashalal tzon uvakar reshit acher. Nizboch Hashem lekecha magilgal. I took the shalal, I took the spoils. Tzon uvakar, the beginning of, right, the cherim, the reshit, the truma, the maser, the beginning to sacrifice to God in Gilgal. Okay, maybe the Mizbeach wasn't Gilgal, not our issue for now. Right? But what is the point of the Shalal, of all of the spoils? Now, we're going to focus on Amalek. When we get to the story, we're going to spend most of our time talking about Agag, because his response is very quick, right? God doesn't want sacrifices, he wants loyalty and obedience, and then he goes and he kills Agag. So everybody focuses on Agag, but for a moment, take a step back and talk about the spoils. Why do we need... Why did the people take the spoils of war in the first place? So he says it's because they wanted to bring sacrifices. I'm not sure. Why did the people take the spoils of war?
They wanted to be like all the other nations.
It's hard for them to destroy these beautiful
sheep, cattle. It's a lot there, right? The people may have been evil and committed terrible things, but the sheep didn't do anything wrong. Right? They're animals.
They're innocent.
So spare the sheep, right? That's one possibility. It's another possibility. Vatat el hashalal doesn't mean that they took the spoils of they took the cattle because they had compassion on these wonderful, poor, innocent animals. Tzar balei chayim. Although that's the term he uses. Towards the end, right? Mm-hmm. We had the.
They could have taken them to enrich themselves.
the compassion over the asher chamal ha'am al mitavatzon. But when Shmuel describes it, he doesn't describe it as chamal ha'am al mitavatzon. They had compassion over the tzon. He describes it as
ta'at
el ha'shalal. They pounced upon the spoils. They jumped on the spoils. Even the word shalal is complicated, because shalal means spoils of war. What do you need spoils of war for? They're supposed to destroy Amalek. They're supposed to make it a cherem like Yericho. Why do they need spoils of war? So there's this question out there, which I'm going to leave for a moment, why the spoils of war became a relevant variable in the story of Amalek. And we're going to jump now to go back to Perek Yud Gimel and Yud Dalet, the middle battle. So let's start from Perek Yud Gimel. The beginning of Perek Yud Gimel. And we're going to have three pieces of the story. This story is a very long story. It's two whole prakim. I just want to show you some pieces of it. This is the battle with the Plishtim. If you remember, when Shmuel first comes to meet Shaul, right at the very beginning in Perek Tet, God's in that beautiful story where that was a sort of the positive description of Malchus, where God says to Shmuel, I'm going to send you a leader and he's going to save Israel from the hands of the Plishtim. The Plishtim was a relevant story there. Ben Shana Shau b'malcho, u'shtei shanim malach ha'Yisrael, v'yivcha lo Shaul 3,000 Yisrael, v'yu im Shaul 2,000 b'michmas, u'bahar bet el, v'elef ayu im Yonatan b'kivat b'nyamin, v'yet ra'am shilach ish lo alav. What do I have in this description? Shaul chose 3,000 soldiers, 1,000 with him with Shaul, and 2,000 with him in Michmas, 1,000 with Yonatan his son in Givat Binyamin. What do I have? The rest he sent home. Who are these 3,000 people?
His army now.
His army. It's the beginning of his army. He doesn't need everybody. He's going to take out a garrison of Plishtim. He doesn't need the entire people of Israel. So he takes 3,000. He sends the rest home. V'yatar am shilach ish lo alav. V'yach Yonatan et netziv Plishtim Hashem begeva. Yonatan strikes first. This is part of that story we'll look at later. Yonatan strikes first. He takes out the garrison of the Plishtim in Geva. V'yishmu'u Plishtim. The Plishtim heard. Shaul taka b'shafar b'chol ha'aretz l'man yishmua ivim. Shmuel blew the shofar and they began to come. In other words, it starts as a small campaign of 3,000 people. Yonatan strikes first, takes out the garrison of the Plishtim. The result is that the Plishtim mobilize, Israel mobilizes. Now it's a full call up. פסוק ד' בוכה ישראל שמעו לאמור היכה שאול את נציב פלישתים וגם נבש ישראל בפלישתים ויצעקו העם אחרי שאול הגלגל. גלגל is a recurring theme in this whole story. They keep coming back to גלגל. They come running to גלגל. ופלישתים נאספו להילחם עם ישראל. The פלישתים gathered to fight against Israel. 30,000 רכב ו6,000 פרשים ועם ככל אשר על שפת הים לרוב. They gathered 30,000 chariots and 6,000 riders and soldiers like the sand of the sea. Vayelu vayachalu b'michmas. Ve'ish Yisrael ve'u kitzar lo ki nigas ha'am v'yitchabu ha'am b'marot u'b'chavachim u'b'slaim u'b'tzalechim u'b'barot. Israel saw that they were outnumbered, outgunned, and outmaneuvered. They began to run. They began to hide. Skip Pasuk Zion. Vayochel shivat yamim lamoed asher Shmuel v'lo ba Shmuel Gilgal v'yafetz ha'am me'alav. Shmuel's waiting for Shaul. Shaul's waiting for Shmuel. Why is Shaul waiting for Shmuel?
For the sacrifices?
For those sacrifices. Remember, that was what he told them back in Perek Yud. Wait for me for 7 days. In the meantime, he's waiting for 7 days, and the people are restless. They're running. They're scared, so they're running. He's waiting for 7 days. Finally, so Shaul says, okay, I'll bring my own sacrifices. He finished the sacrifices, and Shmuel showed up. So Shaul went out. Shaul went out to greet him. Vayomer Shmuel, ma asita? What did you do? Vayomer Shaul, ki ra'iti, ki nafatza ame alai. I saw the people were dispersing. So I saw the people were dispersing. Vatalo batala mo'eda yamim, and you didn't come. Uplishtim ne'esafim b'michmas, and the plishtim are gathering. I said, if the plishtim attack me here in Gilgal and I haven't yet brought sacrifices, I haven't davened, I haven't said tefillot, I haven't beseeched God, I will be in trouble. I have so I brought the sacrifices. So of course Shmuel gets very angry at him and he says, V'yomer Shmuel Shaul, niskalta lo shemart at mitzvot Hashem Elokecha asher tzivach. Says to him, okay, you're done. Now, God was going to give you this kingdom forever. Now it's not going to be. Now somebody else is going to take over the kingdom from you. So you see already a story before Amalek that the problem has begun early and it's been identified. Shaul is still king. We haven't taken the kingdom away from Shaul, but we have taken it away from his descendants. Or at least from identifying them as with his descendants.
These animals must have reference to the animals.
We're going to come to the animals in a moment, but it's interesting for the second time, chronologically it's reversed, but for the second time, Shaul's reference here is to the... No, well, if you compare it to Amalek... What's driving Shaul's mistake?
The people.
He's afraid of them.
Right? He's afraid of the people. In the case of Amalek, he seems to be afraid of the people. Maybe it's fear. I think there's something else, and I'll show you in a moment what I think it is. But there's a driving issue here related to the people. Okay? Now,
and this is the same thing that happened with the golden calf.
And similar issue with the gold. Correct.
Mistake or whatever, misinterpretation,
right.
The pressure.
Why? It felt like a test. Like you didn't come at any point in time and the people were freaking out.
That's what I'm saying. Oh. That's, right. I'm saying it's the same thing.
Now, there's another piece to the story. And that is, so we're going to skip the whole story. Pretend we don't know anything about the story, except for what happens at the very end. Jump to Perek Yedaled. There's only one story. With the Yonatan and the honey and the forest and whatever. I'm going to jump to Pasuk Lamed Aleph. Vayakub ayom ahu baplishtim mimichmas ayalona. We're going to go and attack Michmas. They attack the plishtim in Michmas near Ayalon. The people were very tired. Why they're tired and exhausted at this point is part of the story. The people pounced upon the spoils. They were so hungry, they were so exhausted, and they were so enticed by the spoils that they literally ate the animals, tzar balechayim, eiver min hachai, live. They flew. Right, it's the second time we have the same phrase. We're doing it in reverse order, but it's this. Ve'yagidu l'Shaul le'mor inei ha'am chotim la'Hashem l'chol al adam. Shaul, the people are sinning terribly. They're eating the blood of the animal. They're eating the animals alive. Ve'yomer begadetem, you're rebelling. Bring me a stone. His It's a complicated conjugation of the word his se, siyeu. Ushchattem bazeh v'achaltem. I'll slaughter it for you. Bring me a stone, bring me a knife, bring me your animal, and I'll slaughter it. And don't eat the dam. And that's what he does. Now look at Pasuk Lamed Vav. V'yomer Shaul nirda acharei plishtim laila. Tonight we're going to attack the plishtim. V'navosu behem ador haboker. By the time the morning comes, we will
wipe them out.
What is navoza behem? What is bizui?
Spoils.
Spoils of war. Bizui in shalal of the same word. Mm-hmm. Spoils of war. V'lona she'er behem ish. We will not leave any man alive, but we will take the spoils. So understand what's going on. Both here and in the case of Amalek. Why are the spoils such a central part of the story?
Well, in this story, they're allowed to take the spoils after this.
He encourages them. He tells them, we'll attack, we'll take the spoils.
That time when they ate it raw, but now they're supposed to.
Right.
Like the other one, they were not supposed to.
And they, by God's command, they weren't supposed to take the spoils. They did take the spoils, and Shaul let them take the spoils, ostensibly to bring sacrifices, but I don't necessarily believe that for a minute. What's the common theme behind all of this?
It was their reward.
It's their reward for what? Reward for?
Fighting with him.
For fighting. The reward for coming. The reward
uniting,
for fighting.
Uniting.
Right? You come to fight for me, and I will give you... Right? What motivates people to come and fight for in a battle? What motivates them is that when the battle's over, they get to be rewarded. That's their payment. Mm-hmm. Except we have a problem. What's the problem?
Well, for Amalek,
if you're a shofet, and you need to call the people to arms, and you have no way of forcing them to come to fight for you, then you need to entice them. You need to bribe them. You need to bring them to the people, to the battlefield. And so the way you do that in the ancient world is to promise them spoils. If you are a melech and therefore have the authority to establish, right? Remember Mishpat HaMulucha? Confiscate the sons, confiscate the daughters, confiscate the land, confiscate the cattle. Why? Because you establish an army. Your army is not driven by the spoils of war. Your army is driven by the soldiers.
It's not a voluntary army.
Right. And this is the consistent pattern in Shaul's mindset, is he's bribing the people to come to battle instead of recognizing as melech, the army is his. Right? This is the distinction. He's constantly going to the people for his authorization, for his legitimization. He needs the people in order to be established, and if the people are running from him, then he loses everything. Instead of recognizing that his authority is granted and he has the ability to impose that authority. If you're early in the establishment, if you need to buy the loyalty of the people, then the way you do that is to say to them, okay, come fight for me and you can win the spoils of war. But if you're the melech and you have to impose that authority, then you impose it, it comes from you. And so all the stories of Shaul, from the battle of, even the battle of Yavesh Gilad, to some extent, was motivated, remember the Bakar, was motivated not by a sense of, I'm the king, acharai, come, right, you're my army, but was motivated by the injustice of it. Right? Go back to Yavesh Gilad, it's injustice of it. But he's constantly drawing his authority from the loyalty of the people rather than from the authority of the kingship. And so essentially he conducts his malchus, and here's the takeaway, if you will, he conducts himself in his kingship as if he was a shofet. It would be consistent with the pattern of a shofet, whose authority is temporary and draws from the people. When you have a constitutionalized melech with a mishpat ha-melucha and an authority of the Navi, then you're in a different ballgame. Sha'ul is playing the game of Shofet, even though he was established as a Melech. And that and the theme that represents that is the spoils of war. And you see it throughout. All right, we will stop here, Bezrat Hashem, and I will try to figure out, moving forward, whether we go back to Yavesh Gilad for a little bit, or we...